from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Katie Orr in for Michael Krasny.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill.
This song taught a lot of us how a bill in Washington, D.C. becomes a law. But how does it work in California? More than 2,500 bills have been introduced in the California legislature to be considered this year. And in this hour, we'll dig into the details of California's legislative process. We'll talk about what determines whether a bill lives or dies, and how well the whole system is working. What questions do you have about how laws are made in California? That's next, after the news.
It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No, but how I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill, now you're a law.
Oh, yes!
Welcome to Forum. I'm Katie Orr, in today for Michael Krasny. In a veto message, Jerry Brown once wrote, "Not every human condition deserves a law," but a California bill has likely been written for all of them, considering the enormous number of bills the legislature takes up every year. This year, they're considering more than 2,500 bills. And in this hour, we'll talk about the process in California. How does a bill become a law, and how well is that system working? Joining me now to talk about how things are working are three women who know the Capitol inside and out. First, we have CalMatters reporter Laurel Rosenthal. Thanks, Laurel, for joining us today.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Then we have Delaney Hunter. She's managing partner for California Advisors, a Sacramento-based lobbying firm. Hey, Delaney.
Good morning, Katie.
And we have Aaron Baum, chief of staff for Assemblymember David Chu. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Katie.
So before we get started, I think it's important to put in context how many bills we are dealing with. As I mentioned, 2,500 bills this year. In a two-year session, assembly members are allowed to introduce 50 bills. Senators can present 40. If everyone presents everything they're allowed to present in a two-year session, we get 5,600 bills. So, Aaron, let's go to you. How likely is it that members will introduce the full amount of bills that they're allowed to?
It's a good question. I would say unlikely overall. It's definitely a question of bandwidth for each office.
And is there like, sort of an arms race, right? Though, if your coworker is presenting 20, you don't want to be seen as slacking and only present 15. Is there any of that going on?
I would say it depends. It depends. It's office by office. But I would say there's a definite feeling of competition every now and again.
So how do we come up with these ideas? What are the first steps? Aaron, again, just because you have been working in the legislature for a while, tell me, how do your bosses often come up with these ideas?
Well, if you're like anything, the member that I currently work for, you walk in the last day of session with a binder full of about an inch's worth of newspaper articles and announce to your staff that these are the ideas you'd like to work on next year. But the source of the ideas vary. They can be passion projects for the member, passion projects for staff. Frequently, they are partnerships with advocacy groups in Sacramento who have set their own agendas for the following year and are looking for partners.
And Delaney, what is this time like for you as a lobbyist? I imagine you're trying to get your ideas. You're trying to get someone to pick those up.
I think it's probably best described as organized chaos. especially for a firm that has a wide swath of clients across many topic areas. It's been a mad scramble since, frankly, December around trying to get bills placed. And now it's sorting through those bills and determining not only sort of the path for the bills that we are working most directly on, but also the other, say, 2,400 bills that are out there and in the space that we work in.
Right, because you're not just worried about your own bills. You might be worried about how another bill could affect some of your issues.
Yeah, and in most cases, that's the lion's share of the work that we do.
So you have to be on top of everything.
Exactly.
So, Laurel, what is it like for you as a political reporter? I know, you know, the session hasn't really gotten started, but are you still kind of like looking around, seeing what you think you might be following?
Always. I mean, I think at this time you start assessing what are going to be the big themes for the year, what are kind of going to be the hottest, most contentious issues for the legislative year, and then also just try to get a sense of kind of what's coming back that may have been something that failed in the past, especially now that we have a new governor. That's something I'm looking at a lot, or kind of the things that are going to be on round two. The legislation that Jerry Brown vetoed last time that, you know, members might think they have a better shot with Governor Newsom. And then, of course, the other part about this this part of the cycle that we're in now is that, you know, I think the conventional understanding when we hear the, you know, I'm just a bill kind of jingos and learn civics as children is that we think that all these ideas for new laws come from the elected officials who make the decisions. And the reality is that, you know, some of the ideas come from them, but a lot of them come from interest groups across the political spectrum who go around shopping their ideas in the legislature and trying to find someone to carry their bill. And that is very much a part of the process in Sacramento. And, you know, it's so much established that they even, you know, have a name for it. They call it sponsored bills, bills that are sponsored by interest groups. And so that is another big piece of it, is trying to assess kind of which interests are going after, you know, after what issues, and then the legislators sort of line up to help them rather than necessarily the legislators having the ideas and the interest groups supporting or opposing. It works both ways.
And so when a bill is actually, when it's time for it actually to be written into the form that, you know, people will see when they look it up on like Ledge Info, a website where you can go and track legislation, that goes to something called the Legislative Counsel's Office. Those are attorneys that actually write up the legal language of the bill. But I'm interested, and I don't know, Delaney, maybe you can talk, and Aaron, do sponsors who obviously have a big stake in these bills and authors, the Assembly and senators themselves, do they try and influence how those bills are written in the first place from the Legislative Counsel's office?
I would say the answer is yes, in that at least in a specific area that you work in, if you've been sort of, you know, pretty steeped in that section of code or in the policy area, I think, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to frame the issue and putting together at least our attempt at what we think the language should look like. That is obviously then massaged and reviewed and then, you know, sort of crafted by Ledge Counsel, and what comes out the other end is often not what we put in at the beginning. And that becomes then a negotiating a piece. And again, it's understanding what the intent of the legislative language is from the beginning, and then Ledge Counsel helping to craft that and making sure that the intent of the draft actually meets the words on the page.
So what questions do you have about how a bill becomes law? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Okay, so when a bill gets back from the Ledge Counsel's office, it has to sit for a while. And in that time, the Rules Committee will assign it to a Policy Committee. So Rules is sort of the housekeeping committee for the Assembly and then the Senate. They each have their own Rules Committees. So typically, these bills are supposed to be assigned based on what policy areas they cover. But Aaron, I wonder, is there ever any politics at play? I mean, you know, does like leadership, if they want to see a bill in a certain area, do they have a say on where that can go?
I think leadership always has the discretion to make a say here and there. I will say that in recent history, I haven't seen a ton of examples that demonstrate that, but it's always a possibility.
What do you think, Laurel?
I think everything that happens in the Capitol is subject to politics. So sure, yes, it definitely happens.
Aaron, when you're in the committee hearing, what is the goal of that committee? What are you trying to get out of it? And when do you start beginning to have a sense of whether or not you're actually going to be successful with this bill?
It's a process. I think that, you know, anybody's goal in a committee hearing is roughly the same. It's to get out with as much support as possible. As staff, we are trying to frame the issue as best we can for the discussion in committee. We get a sense of whether or not the bill's going to pass out based on early discussions with committee staff and the questions that they're asking us through having individual discussions with committee members and their staff to get a sense of what their hard stops are going to be on any given policy.
And Delaney, what are you looking for when a bill goes to its first policy committee?
I think it's the first chance to sort of truth test your intent and your concept and sort of letting it be out in the public space, which is other interest groups weighing in, members of the legislature weighing in with their particular ideas or bent on that issue. It's really the first place that you get to essentially daylight whether you have alignment in a policy forum or not. And that's essentially the first real test of whether your idea is going to cut it or not cut it. And what I'd say is, you know that pretty well in advance of the actual hearing. I think it's pretty basic knowledge in the space is if you don't know what your vote count is in that committee, you don't take up your bill. So we know pretty well in advance, you know, every once in a while you'll get surprised and a vote will shift in a way that you didn't expect in committee, but that's pretty rare.
We have CJ from Oakland on the line who believes that there are too many bills being introduced. CJ, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm just concerned that perhaps the legislators do not do enough research in terms of the practical impact of some of these bills. In particular, I run a small nonprofit, but it's a business. And there's a bill right now that would prohibit paper receipts. And for me, there's so many really horrible negative impacts about that, not the least of which is electronic receipts can be altered very easily. If there are no paper receipts, theft, internal theft, is made much easier. And I understand CVS has really long paper receipts, specifically maybe something toward that one company, but to put all of us under that these new restrictions, I mean, it would have a horrible effect on my small nonprofit.
Well, and this is something that we do hear a lot. There are a lot of bills introduced in California. We are a full-time legislature, and, you know, that can sometimes lead to unintended consequences. I mean, Laurel, what have you heard about this? Is this something you hear from readers?
Well, first of all, I want to respond to the caller. The bill she's talking about is by Assemblyman Phil Ting from San Francisco. And my understanding of the bill is not that it would prohibit paper receipts, but that it would make them available only upon request. So that's a difference. The idea behind the bill is to make electronic email receipts the default option, the automatic option in a transaction, but customers would always have the ability to ask for a paper receipt. It's similar to what the legislature did with plastic straws last year, where they didn't out and out ban plastic straws, but they just made them only available when customers request them. So that is something to consider. And of course, members of the public should always get in touch with their elected representatives and express their opinions because the legislature is supposed to serve the people.
And next we have Andrea from Petaluma who has a... Oh, Andrea, what is your question?
Hello, hello. I have a quick question. I was just curious when you mentioned the sponsoring bills. This might be very straightforward. I'm just unaware and feel like it's very important. Is it okay for those people once they say I'm going to take on your issue of this particular bill, that particular group? Are they allowed to say, well, we will give you then money for your next campaign and we'll endorse you in the next campaign, or is that a quid pro quo?
That is absolutely illegal.
Okay.
Unequivocally.
It's illegal to make it explicit and to have any conversation that connects a policy position and a fundraising transaction is against the law. At the same time, there is a lot of confluence between those things, but they're done legally by not discussing it explicitly. And so oftentimes groups that sponsor a bill will also be donors to the legislator who carries that bill. That is very common. It's just that what would make it illegal would be to have it be an explicit, I'll do this if you give me that.
And Delaney, is it hard to walk those lines sometimes and maintain certainly the legal parameters, but the ethical parameters as well?
I would say, and I think history would bear out that the answer is yes. However, on a personal level, it's not hard at all. It's just not. I just don't do it. I make sure that there's a very bright line, and I am far away from that line at all times. It's how I maintain my business. It's why I'm actually successful in my business. If my clients thought that there was problems with my ethical frame of an issue, or if legislators thought that I was up against that line, I'd have a problem just conducting my business. So I haven't struggled with that in my career because I make sure the line is very bright and I stay very far away from it.
And if I could just piggyback off that, I would say that I agree with where Delaney is coming from. The FPPC has very clear lines in the sand on this, and it makes it easier, at least on the part of staff, to stay away from those kinds of conversations because even hinting at it is so clearly against the rules.
And also, this is Laurel with CalMatters. You know, there's ongoing routine training that people who are involved in the policymaking process go through. So I know for lobbyists, what is it, every 2 years, I think, members and staff also have routine training where they learn these laws around the ethics and sort of how to keep the political fundraising part of their jobs separate from the policymaking part of their jobs. And, you know, every so often we do see an enormous scandal in this area, but it's almost been like once a generation in Sacramento. You know, a few years ago, there was obviously the issue with San Francisco Senator Leland Yee and Los Angeles Senator Ron Calderon, both Democrats who were taken down by the FBI in separate unrelated bribery scandals. You know, problems of that level of rising to the level of, you know, federal crimes seem to happen about once per generation.
I want to get to a quick comment. Ron says in 2010, the San Jose Mercury News published an article stating that 65% of the laws that originated in the Assembly and 52% of the laws that originated in the Senate were sponsored bills. Are the rates the same today? And do you guys think that this is a problem at all? Or do you think that, you know, you could make the argument that interest groups are the ones that are in touch with what their constituents need and want?
I haven't done a statistical analysis in a few years, so I couldn't answer the first question. My sense is that it probably isn't very different. You know, that sponsored bills are a very significant part of the sort of overall legislative product. And my take is that it's not necessarily good or bad, but what is problematic is that there isn't consistent transparency around when bills are sponsored and when they're written by the author. A few years ago, I did an investigation into this issue of sponsored bills. And what I learned then was that it's really just up to each committee when they write an analysis to determine whether they cite in their analysis that a particular bill is sponsored by an outside group. And so what you have is some committees sort of do that with a lot of regularity and others don't do it. Some interest groups really want to be out there as bill sponsors, particularly labor unions. They really want to show their members that they are in Sacramento getting their agenda done. And so they're very out there showing that they're sponsoring bills. On the other hand, you may have private corporations that are sponsoring bills and there will be no fingerprints of it whatsoever because if they don't want to be disclosed as the sponsor, they don't have to be. So I think what the system needs more of is just more consistency around what bills are sponsored and what bills aren't, because there's nothing to stop a legislator from saying, you know, oh, yeah, that's my bill. In fact, I wrote about one of those a few years ago where, you know, the legislator was sort of insisting that it was his bill that he was his idea. And at the same time, there had been coverage in the New York Times about how legislators in states all over the United States were carrying this exact same bill that was sponsored by pharmaceutical companies. And yet you have a legislator in Sacramento saying, oh, no, that was my own idea. Well, it was the exact same language as these bills in other states that were sponsored by Big Pharma. So I think the public would benefit from having more transparency and more consistency on that kind of disclosure.
That's Laurel Rosenthal with CalMatters. I would like to invite you to call us with your questions about how a bill becomes a law. What do you want to know about? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Erin, I wanted to get to you with just a process question. We had talked earlier, and you were telling me that, you know, bills, it's not uncommon for bills to be double referred to policy committees, but they can also be triple referred. And you said that that's not usually good when they're triple referred. Why not?
You run into a basic issue of timelines. We have a hard deadline by which policy committees have to hear all bills, and getting even a couple of hearings in before that deadline can be difficult, depending on in which order your bill is referred and whether or not that committee meets weekly or biweekly. But triple referral makes it very tough to get out by the policy deadline, and that is a hard and fast rule unless you have a rule waiver, which are very difficult to get.
And then, forgive me, explain for people what a referral means when you're referred to a committee.
It's the procedural action taken by Rules Committee initially to refer your bill or send it on its way to the appropriate policy committee. If you're double referred, the action out of the first policy committee is it's adopted either with or without amendments, and then referred on to the next policy committee that was in line waiting to hear it.
When you get a bill back and you kind of know its path, you know, maybe it has to go to one committee or another committee. Is there ever a moment of like relief, like, oh, thank God it's going to this committee and not another one, or a moment of panic? What is some of the responses?
I think that, yeah, that we every now and again we have bills that are referred to a policy committee where we have maybe a little less familiarity with the committee, the chair, the staff, and it's hard to know what the framing is going to be in that committee, and we just have to be extra careful. There are other committees in which we have a lot of bills, and we generally know the staff and how they frame issues and know the chair and what their policy positions are. So I would say, yeah, you know, depending on the referral, it can trigger a sense of panic or a sense of relief.
We're talking about how a bill becomes a law with CalMatters reporter Laurel Rosenthal, Delaney Hunter, she's a managing partner with California Advisors, and Erin Baum, she's chief of staff for Assemblymember David Chu. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Katie Orr in for Michael Krasny. We're talking today about how a bill becomes a law in the California legislature. We go now to Greg from Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, I kind of feel like constituents are not really involved in the process. And I was wondering, you know, why isn't there a better forum for the constituents to really find out what's going on with the bill and how to participate in it, and how I, as a constituent, can see how my legislator is voting on things and why they're voting on things and how many of my constituents, agree with it or disagree with it. I kind of feel like we're putting these people in office and then they're kind of, you know, free to do whatever they want with these special interests or people that are professionals in the field.
Erin, why don't you comment on that? How does your boss try and incorporate constituent opinion into which bills he chooses to put forward?
Well, there's the initial sort of basic, we record all of our constituent calls. We have a database and software for which we can produce reports on the type of feedback that we're getting, not only on the bills that our office has authored, but also bills authored by other members. To the more non-traditional town halls and listening tours. It is tough to maintain contact with a district of 500,000 people, and we have to figure out how to expend those resources efficiently. But we try to, you know, we really try to do our best to maintain contact with our constituents and make it clear that we're passing those messages along to the assembly member. You know, he is aware of all the calls that our office receives on any given issue, because likely if one person's calling, it's more likely that 50 people have called.
And tell me, how does like Twitter and all of that change the dynamics of how involved constituents are?
I started working in this building before Twitter, and I remember when Twitter exploded, and it has made it much easier to understand how frequently an issue is cited or brought up or is occupying sort of a much bigger space in any day's narrative.
We have a comment here. A listener asks, what can the public do to help kill a bill? Do you just call and write your representative? Is there anything else that you can do to really make your message stand out?
Calling and writing is good. That is the first step and a good step. I think that, you know, speaking purely on behalf of, you know, somebody who works primarily with a lot of issue-based advocacy groups, it's really important when those people are working with organizations that have a voice in Sacramento or have a really regular voice in Sacramento. I think I feel like we work for a particularly engaged district. Our constituents are never shy about reaching out either individually or through advocacy organizations.
And another listener asks, how much opportunity is there in committees for public input by individuals, not just interest groups? And how often does this happen? And you can explain a little bit about the public testimony, but it can be, you know, it can be hard for people to make it physically to Sacramento.
It is hard to make it to Sacramento. I personally always very appreciative and impressed when people can take what amounts to almost an entire day to be up here for a committee hearing. Letters, calls, making the committee aware of the points of any particular bill that you have a problem with is always good. If you make a particularly salient point, it's always possible that can end up in the committee analysis. But next to that, you're right, the committee hearing is sort of the next best place to air your issues with a bill. Depending on the committee rules, there's usually a couple primary witnesses who get an opportunity to take the time to really lay out all of the policy issues, and then following that, everybody else gets to add on and associate their names with the comments made before them. But everybody gets an opportunity to get up and say their name one way or the other.
Katie,
go. Oh yes, continue, please.
Oh yeah, hi, it's Laurel. I just wanted to jump in and respond to the caller who asked about sort of monitoring and paying attention to what his elected representatives are up to in Sacramento. And, you know, one thing is that most legislators are pretty active on social media. The amount to which they personally do the engagement and write the posts and whatnot versus have their staff do it depends from office to office. But I have spoken with legislators who say that, you know, their Facebook page, for example, can be a really powerful way for them to communicate with their constituents and hear what people in their district, you know, feel on any given issue. So that would be one idea for the caller to follow his elected representatives on social media and use that as a way to engage. And the other thing is, I will give a plug for CalMatters. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom based in Sacramento with the goal of covering the California legislature and the Capitol, explaining the policies and the personalities here. And so please check us out, subscribe, and we also have a tool where we explain the new legislature and allow you to kind of match your own demographics to those of the legislature and really see how much the legislature is representative of you as a Californian. So calmatters.org.
That's a really cool tool, I have to say. I've used it. as things in my life change, I'll go and say, oh, how many people in the legislature are just like me right now? Let's go to another call. Edgar from Redwood City, you're on.
Hi, buenos dias. I wanted to ask, what exactly does sponsoring a co-sponsoring a bill entail? Are there costs involved? Are they responsible for the lawyers behind the bill, the wording, that sort of thing?
Delaney, let's go to you on that.
Sure. You are essentially an extension of the legislator's staff, for lack of a better term. As a sponsor, we would help early on in the drafting of the concept and the language of the bill. We would help staff in drafting sort of fact sheets and documents and doing a lot of the legwork around the bill. We would obviously negotiate with the committee around any necessary amendments if those were there. We would engage in communication with the members of that committee on the bill. So we essentially act as an extension of the staff. At the end of the day, though, the legislator's name is on that bill. And if they're not okay with an amendment, with a concept, or don't feel comfortable moving a bill, that's 100% their discretion. But again, as a sponsor, we would, you know, obviously work and negotiate and try to, at the end of the day, come to something that that author is proud to have their name on and that we think actually either solves a problem or creates a solution that sort of needs to be managed.
Well, and we've seen this happen. I remember one high-profile case. Former Senator Mark Leno was pursuing a bill about e-cigarettes and limiting, I believe, the age when you could use them. And he had some amendments. He called them hostile amendments put on his bill in an assembly committee, and he dropped the bill right there. So getting to your point, Delaney, he didn't feel like it was something he could associate his name with anymore, and he publicly walked away from it. That's always stood out to me. It was one of the more dramatic moments of a committee meeting. Sometimes they can seem pretty routine, but I think that just was, you know, something that happens behind the scenes sort of came to the forefront for a moment. I want to talk a little bit about Appropriations Committee. It might sound dry, but really, most bills in the legislature have to go through what's called the Appropriations Committees. Basically, if you're spending money or you're going to affect the state budget, you have to go to the Appropriations Committee. Of those, many of those get automatically placed on what we call the suspense file. If you're allocating a certain limit of money, if you meet a threshold, you automatically go on to the suspense file. So, Aaron, talk to me a little bit about the purpose of the suspense file. This means that the committee essentially will not take up these bills, and we're talking hundreds of bills, till about a week before the deadline when they have to make it out of that house. What's happening in that time?
On a staff end, we are working with our sponsors or internally to sort of get a sense of the correct cost estimate of that bill. And just to recap, the suspense file is where any bill that costs more than $150,000 on the assembly side, that's the rule, goes to the suspense file, where the committee gets the opportunity to press pause on that and all the other high cost bills to evaluate them all at one time. So on a staff side, we are working to correctly gauge the cost of our proposal and then working furiously to figure out what kind of language we could adopt that would reduce those costs, and working sort of very closely with committee staff who have on their plates probably just an insane number of bills to evaluate all at one time to see if there's a possible way to reduce the cost and get the committee to agree to let the bill out to the floor.
And Laurel, talk about some of the political implications. I know we said politics is always at play in this process, but the suspense file really gives leadership an opportunity to kind of sit down with the members and say, okay, of the bills you have on suspense, what do you want to see through? It also gives them a chance to say, you know, we just don't feel like we have the votes for this bill this year. We're going to make a play for this bill. Talk a little bit about your experience covering some of that.
Yeah, this phase of the process, the Appropriations Committee and the suspense file, is really the way to snuff out a bill that the majority party doesn't want to go on the record as opposing. So here, for many years, the Democrats have been in control. That means this is the place where basically Democrats can kill bills without going on the record and associating their own name with that act. And that's because things can be just what they call held in suspense without a vote that has their name on it. So rather than if a bill goes to the floor of either house, then each lawmaker has their name associated with a yes or no vote on that bill. And then they face the associated accountability when they face the electorate or future donors or anything else. In the suspense file, bills can just sort of be stopped in their tracks, and there's not each house kind of has slightly different procedures, which I won't go into right here, but it's easy to just kind of hold it with no fingerprints. And so this would be bills that that Democrats would either feel embarrassed to vote no on or would upset some important constituencies if they vote no on. And yet at the same time, there may be reasons that that they just don't want to go out there with that opposition. And so every year there are always interesting bills that just kind of stop at this point in the process. It's technically supposed to be that bills are reviewed at this point based on their cost, but that's not the only factor. In fact, I've had a former appropriations chairman tell me that the appropriations committee is basically the legislature's equivalent of the veto power, and that it's a way to just kind of stop something from moving ahead. And over the years, things that have died in appropriations are, you can understand why they wouldn't want to put it to the floor, because it would be embarrassing to kill it there. For example, for many years, a bill died in appropriations that would have given legislative staff members whistleblower protection, the same kind of whistleblower protection that state civil servants have that workers in the legislature did not have. And that was killed in appropriations for, I think, at least 4, maybe 5 years before the whole Me Too movement blew up. And then there was sufficient political pressure that it had to get passed and was signed into law. Sometimes there are environmental bills that will be held in suspense, or bills that create more accountability for law enforcement. School spending transparency, these kinds of things that would be politically embarrassing to kill on the floor, they just kind of quietly hold them in suspense.
What questions do you have about how a bill becomes a law? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Let's go now to the phones. Chris from San Jose, you're on.
Yeah, I have a question about this particularly shameful practice in the legislature of what they call gut and amend. We had a Central Valley groundwater pumping bill a few years back that went all the way through the legislature. And then at the very last minute, they took the bill, gutted it, turned it into a gun control bill, and sent it to the governor. Is this a common practice?
The infamous gut and amends. We hear a lot about those. Aaron, first of all, let's just get a sense from you. How often does this happen in the legislature?
It's infrequent. It does happen, but it's infrequent because the kinds of rule waivers involved after you've passed important deadlines are very hard to get.
And Laurel, there have been recent changes in gut and amend, right? They can't do them in the last hour now. They have to do them. They have to have at least 72 hours that the bill has to be in print before they can take a vote. But explain to us a little bit about how gut and amends have been used in the legislature.
Yeah, it is definitely one of the stranger phenomenons in the legislature, especially, when I came to start covering, I was used to covering local governments like school boards and city councils where they have a Brown Act and they have to post their agenda 10 days in advance and they can't take actions at the last minute. It's not that way in the legislature. They have different rules. And what the example that your caller described is not I would say it's not the norm in that most bills don't follow that procedure. At the same time, it's not unheard of. There, every year that does happen with a certain portion of bills. And at one point it was, you know, it would be literally in the final hours of a legislative session in the middle of the night, 10 p.m., 11 p.m., midnight, 1 a.m., you know, legislators were seeing bills for the very first time, and they would take a break from the floor and run upstairs to a hearing room and maybe hold a 12-minute hearing on a piece of legislation and then rush back down to the floor and cast a vote. And I remember even watching several years ago, this was a gut and amend bill that was it's the reason why we have all of our ballot initiatives on the November ballot now instead of, it used to be that some of them were in June and some were in November. Well, that year there was a ballot measure that Democrats didn't like that was going to go on the June ballot. It was sort of seen as an anti-labor measure. And so in order to move it to the November ballot, when there would be a more liberal turnout and have a better odds of defeating the measure, they passed this gut and amend law that moved all of the initiatives to the November ballot. And they cast their very first vote on that bill after midnight on the very last night of the legislative session. And I remember Democrats getting up and making speeches saying, the process here has been horrible. This is terrible. We shouldn't be making new laws like this. But I'm going to vote for it anyway. And so there had been kind of enough of those incidents where people were, legislators were making laws on the fly. Citizens had no opportunity to weigh in and tell their representatives what they thought about it because everything was happening in the dark of night. And so there was an initiative a couple years ago to require this 72-hour rule that you mentioned, Katie. And so now the gut and amend process happens with a little bit more of a buffer. So if there is a bill that's gutted at the last minute and amended, it's not, it's at least done 3 days before it gets its vote. So there are 3 days for journalists to write about it, for citizens to tell their representatives what they think. And so that has changed the process, created a little bit more openness and transparency. Not to say that there's no more gut and amends, but just that they're kind of happening a few days before the end instead of literally, you know, at midnight.
And I should add, too, that gut and amends do serve a purpose in that they let lawmakers respond to issues that might come up after, you know, the bill introduction deadline. I'm thinking specifically about Shirley Weber, who had introduced, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who had introduced a bill last year in response to the Stephon Clark shooting that would have changed use of force policies for the police officers. That was a gut and amend, which ultimately died in the Senate. However, it's back again this year. But it does give them a little bit of leeway to kind of respond to the moment and what people are talking about.
Right.
I would like to go now to Claudia from Sacramento. You're on the air.
Thank you. I understand the discussion you had about the cost implications of the bill being hashed out in appropriations, but I'm wondering where and how the conversation about the larger impact, like on the environment or the climate or people's health, do big topics like that that are often data-driven but sometimes with a slant get hashed out in that same venue? And are they attached to cost implications?
Erin, let's go to you.
That's a really good question. It's hard to, there's not the equivalent conversation for big picture issues. I would say that, and I'll let, since Delaney has history in the building, you might want to chime in, but I will say that a good forum for doing that are our oversight hearings. It's where the committee with the particular jurisdiction over an issue gets to bring in specialists to speak on a variety of panels and inform the committee on an issue and on a whole issue. And it's sort of in its scope.
And Delaney, I will ask because, you know, as a lobbyist, you look at certain issues over a long period of time. So I imagine that you are thinking about some of the longer term consequences of these bills.
Indeed. And I think actually the policy committee process, if it's done correctly, is the place to vet the bigger picture. I think the other thing is, right, especially if you have a concentration of legislation in a specific topic area, a good committee chair is going to want to put all those bills up at the same time and think through how they fit together or don't fit together. That's really what the policy committee process is supposed to do. And because a bill will go through that policy process, both in its house of origin, so an assembly bill in the assembly, will then have to go to the Senate and have the same sort of policy review in Senate committees. I mean, that tends to be when you really start putting the pieces together on a larger topic. It tends to be in the second house. Or the legislature does have at its discretion various tools to put a big group of bills together in a specific topic. It's called a conference committee. The most common use of a conference committee is the budget, which is obviously you have to wring out a lot of things in a state as large as California with its budget as big as ours. But the legislature does have at its discretion the tool to use a conference committee when it's a really big issue that needs to be fully vetted and thought about in a comprehensive way.
And we don't want to get too far into the weeds, but we can also mention that the governor can also call a special session if he wants to deal with something specifically. Jerry Brown had done that on a road infrastructure that lasted for, I believe, a year and a half and didn't actually get any legislation out of that from that specific thing, but they can call special sessions. And Delaney, I think you bring up a good point, too, that we haven't really mentioned. And people, you know, depending on how much you know, you have to go through this process on both houses. So if you start in the assembly and you go through your policy committee appropriations, you get a final vote on the floor, you still have to go through it on the Senate side. And as you mentioned, there is often changes in the Senate side, and then it has to come back for a concurrence vote so that the whole legislature is on the same page before a bill that has passed goes to the governor. And I just wanted to, you know, make sure people understand that. We're going to hear from Regina in Sonoma right now. Regina, go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll be brief. Why isn't the public informed or notified via email or news media or some way in order to have a public comment period?
Laurel, do you want to take that?
We're writing articles all the time, and we welcome you to, you know, subscribe to calmatters.org or find the other, you know, any other news outlet that you may be interested in. There is an active, healthy press corps in Sacramento that does write about these things. You also can, you know, follow your own representative, and I think that they each kind of send out email newsletters. If you particularly care about an issue, there is a way online to go to LegInfo, which is the legislature's own bill tracking system, and follow things there. So it does take some work. It's not necessarily just going to come flying at you if you don't seek it out, but the resources are out there.
Yeah, and I think to just highlight Laurel's point, I mean, we're talking about potentially 5,600 bills over the course of 2 years. So it's a lot of bills. They all have to have public comment. They all are noticed for a certain amount of time. But as Laurel said, of course, it's very hard for like an average everyday citizen to maybe track that if they're not specifically following a bill. I want to talk a little bit about the governor, because, of course, it can become law if he doesn't sign it. But at some point, the governor is brought into this conversation. Aaron, do you have a sense when your bill has made it through, like, or is in the second house, whether or not the governor is going to sign your bill?
Much like the work we do in the Appropriations Committee, working with the governor's office is similar. We start conversations with their staff as early as we can. It was, at least under the previous administration, they worked very well with legislative offices to make clear what their concerns were and if they were addressable. I would say that in addition to working with the governor's staff, it's always sort of incumbent upon staff to be reaching out to any affected department or agency staff to get a sense of what their perspective on your proposal is, because they will be informing the governor's staff on that perspective as well.
And just so all our listeners are aware, the governor can sign a bill, he can veto a bill, or if he doesn't take any action within 12 days in the normal session, it becomes law without his signature. And in the end of the session, he has 30 days because there are so many bills. So if he doesn't act within 30 days, it becomes law. Laurel, how unusual is it to see a bill become law without the governor's signature? And what does it say about what he thinks about that bill?
It's very unusual. I don't have the number at my fingertips, but it rarely happens. And I want to just say I'm, you know, reading Jerry Brown's veto letters was always one of the more interesting parts of this job. He had a very kind of, he did write almost all of them himself. He had a very kind of spare, to the point tone. But every now and then he would go on these amazing sort of historical essays, pulling in, you know, legal concepts from ancient Rome and 17th century England. One veto message kind of referred to a 50-year-old essay in the Federal Bar Journal. Just really interesting to read his vetoes. And so I am looking forward to seeing what Governor Newsom's style will be in his task.
We've been talking with Laurel Rosenhall, reporter for CalMatters, Delaney Hunter, managing partner of California Advisors, and Aaron Baum, chief of staff for Assemblymember David Hsu. You can find a link to the California Legislators Just Like You tool that Laurel Rosenthal mentioned at our website, kqed.org/forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.